I'm adding a passage from Genesis as well. The first comes from Genesis chapter 3. This is after Adam and Eve have eaten from the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. These verses come from the punishments. So chapter 3, verse 17. To Adam, God said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, to dust you will return." Then Ecclesiastes, offering commentary on that very punishment. Ecclesiastes chapter 9, beginning with verse 2. "All share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, the clean and the unclean, those who offer sacrifices and those who do not. As it is with the good man, so with the sinner. As it is with those who take oaths, so it is with those who are afraid to take them. This is the evil in everything that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes all. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil, and there is madness in their hearts while they live, and afterward they join the dead. Anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. They have no further reward, and even the memory of them is forgotten. Their love, their hate, and their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun." Then the Gospel of John, chapter 11. We focus on Jesus' own commentary on this situation. It begins with verse 1. "Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, 'Lord, the one you love is sick.' When he heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.' Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days." The succeeding verses speak of further delays, and then we pick up again with verse 17. "On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Mary and Martha to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. 'Lord,' Martha said to Jesus, 'if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you what you ask.' Jesus said to her, 'Your brother will rise again.' Martha answered, 'I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day.' Jesus said to her, 'I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?' 'Yes, Lord,' she told him. 'I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world.' And after she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher is here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up and quickly went to them. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more moved deeply, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. If you've watched the news over this past week, you've seen some of those horrific images that came from Sri Lanka and the terrorism attacks that were over there. Attacks not only in public places, but also churches. And we think about that word, terrorism. Why are there terrorists in the world, and what do they hope to accomplish, and why do we give them that name? We think about that word, terror. And what sorts of things do we fear? We fear the violence in these instances. We fear the death that ultimately is at the heart of those terrible situations. And if we look at this, we think about all the different things that we might fear in our lives. We know people who do not like hospitals. We know people who do not like graveyards. And all the horrific images that come out at Halloween. And at the root of all of them is that common fear of death. And we think about the human condition in which we find ourselves. There are so many things about life that we did not have any control over. We didn't control what our birth date was. We have no control over how tall we grow, though some of us might want that control. We have no control over who our parents are and our families. We're born into these situations. And yet as we grow into them, we become attached to them. And we start thinking, well, I didn't ask to be here, but now that I'm here, I want to keep this. I want to hold on to this. And yet, we know. We've seen examples of other people dying. We have stories of death. We see our own frailties. And when we drive by the cemetery, we may have visions of someday meeting that fate ourselves. And throughout all of this, we have these anxieties. And many people throughout the centuries have spoken about the anxieties that come from this. If you take classes in literature, we talk about the main themes that show up. And death, of course, is one of the central ones. We could go to many different places to have expressions of our anxiety. One of the places that I have gone to previously is the work of Paul Tillich. He was a 20th century theologian. And this book, The Courage to Be, was one of his more popular books. The basic theme is we human beings have a sense of our own coming death. And yet, because of the spark, the image of God within us, we have a longing for immortality, for life everlasting. And the question is, how are we going to handle these anxieties about our own mortality at present? We have to have the courage to be, and we as Christians obviously gather that courage to be from Christ. But at the same time, we still are human. We still deal with our anxieties. And we go to passages like that one in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes may be a book in the Old Testament that you push past because many of us don't want to hear what's in Ecclesiastes about how vain, how empty, how futile human life is, whether we're seeking pleasure, whether we're working hard, whether we are suffering, whether we are living it up. All these situations, as the writer says, there is this inherent evil in every human effort, that great penalty, death. And it is no accident that when the Son of God comes to this earth, that He Himself wrestles with this great problem. We, of course, just celebrated the resurrection last Sunday. But before that great event occurred, there were moments like the passage we read this morning that give images and messages ahead of time to give us a sense of the overarching purpose of the incarnation and what was coming. This is also a crucial time of testing for another one of Jesus' followers. And I like to draw a parallel between this passage and the passage that we also know well where Peter professes that Jesus is the Messiah. And you remember in that passage, Jesus is sitting with his disciples and he asks them, "Who do people say that I am?" Peter stands up and says, "You are the Messiah." Jesus responds by saying, "Blessed are you, Simon, and on your faith I'll build my church. But I'm going into Jerusalem to die." Peter immediately says, "No, Lord, we're not going to let that happen." Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan." And so there's a point of confession, of trust, and then that's put to the test, and a potential failure or lack of faith. Look at Martha's story closely in this passage in the Gospel of John. We begin with those details about Lazarus being sick. And as that unfolds, we're also told that Jesus is very close to this family, that he spent time with Lazarus and Mary and Martha. So much so that they consider him friends, and it says they love him and he loves them. So that when Lazarus gets sick, they immediately send word to Jesus. And there's that expectation, if we send word to you, Jesus, we want you to come immediately. The gospel tells us, though, that Jesus pauses and says this is not going to end in death, but this will be a point for the power of the Son of God to show forth. And it says he remains 2 more days. In the verses that we did not read, there's a discussion between Jesus and the disciples, and they said, well, are you going to go back to Judea? That's where they tried to stone you. And the disciples are very concerned for Jesus. And Thomas even says, well, we're going to follow him and we're going to go die with him. There's that fear surrounding this. And yet Jesus walks into this situation because of his sense of mission, because of the Father's plan, and because of his love for this family. We note that the Gospel of John quickly tells us, as soon as there's word that Jesus is near, what happens? Martha goes running out of the house. She has to intercept him. But what has happened? They've seen their brother decline. They've seen him getting paler and paler. And by this point, he has died. And it's a couple days later. They're wondering what delayed Jesus. Martha comes out of the gate with an indictment. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And here, there's this crucial encounter between Jesus and Martha. Jesus says, your brother will rise. And what's interesting here is Martha evidently has been listening to Jesus, has been listening to the preaching about a coming day of resurrection for his followers. And so she points toward that day. But Jesus is more important. It's asking her to think more importantly about the day that's right in front of her. And what does he say? I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes me, though he dies, yet will he live. And at this point, Mary professes that Jesus is the Messiah. There's that point of faith, as that declaration, just like Peter did. And you could hear Jesus saying, on your faith I will build my church. There is that crucial time. Martha quickly doubles back and grabs Mary. And what does Mary do? She runs out with her indictment, just like Martha did. She was not there for her sister's encounter. But she runs out and says the same thing. And so Jesus says, okay, let's go to the tomb. We have here the shortest verse in the Bible, one of the more telling verses, that Jesus, God's Son, who had been at the ultimate position of authority and privilege, had taken on a human body, now to engage with us in the midst of our suffering. And now here to see what death does to the loved ones who are left behind. And at that point, Jesus says, I'm going to do something about this. Roll the stone away. And here, this is the moment that's very much like Peter saying, no, Lord, I'm not going to let you die. Now here, Martha says, Lord, don't bother. And you know, he's going to smell bad. The rot, the decay has set in. This is several days later. His soul's not there. He's not there. But instead of reprimanding Martha at that point, Jesus says, "Lazarus, come out." You think about this. You think about all the kind of movies that we have about mummies or ghouls or zombies. This would be a perfect example for a nightmarish kind of situation. And yet that's not what this is. This is a point of healing. This is a point of bringing Lazarus out of the tomb. And there's a newness and a freshness to him as they remove the linens. And yet, throughout this, we wonder. We see the response of the crowd. There's a part that immediately puts their faith in Jesus because of this event. But there's another part, like all the tattletellers who run to the Pharisees and say, "Well, guess what Jesus has done now?" Knowing that they are keeping a listing of things that they don't like. You imagine them trying to explain this one. And yet we today would still wrestle with these things if we're honest with ourselves. We think about this because Jesus' resurrection is coming. And yet, this is merely a foretaste of it. Because, as best we understand, Lazarus died again. This is a resuscitation. But Jesus' coming out of the tomb was a resurrection and marked a new life, and he had a new body, and all those resurrection appearances at the end of the Gospels speak of something new. And yet we live in an empirical world, a world dominated with science. We live in a world where we have scholars in the Jesus Seminar voting on parts of the Gospels as to whether they may have happened or whether they probably did not happen. And we live on the other side of Thomas Jefferson's cutting passages out of the Bible, cutting miraculous points, cutting Lazarus's coming out of the tomb out of the Gospels, cutting Jesus's resurrection out of the Gospels. And yet, when we read Paul's writings, and in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15, he's very clear, if we don't have the resurrection, we don't have good news. If we just have Jesus' death, we just have one more martyr to add to the long list of martyrs in human history. Why are we here if the tomb is not empty? And yet at the same time, look at Martha's journey, and she was there. She had just professed that Jesus was the Messiah. She had just heard him say, "I am the resurrection and the life." And yet she still said, "Lord, he stinks." How do we come to grips with the fact that Jesus is Lord over death? Death surrounds us. It characterizes our existence as human beings. How do we dare to hope otherwise? But here, Jesus says that he is Lord of life. And if we are following him, he says to us, "I am the resurrection and the life." What do we say in return? This morning we come to our time of invitation and commitment, hymn number 482, "Jesus is Tenderly Calling." Jesus is calling for each one of us, calling for us to be his disciples, calling to tell us that He is the resurrection and the life. If you've never made that commitment to be His disciple, this church offers this opportunity to you to walk forward, for us to encourage you on that journey as you make a profession of faith. It is also a time for each one of us to claim and hold on to the hope of the resurrection as we stand together and sing hymn number 482.